The next two verses talk about the teachings of the Nyaya and the Vaibhashika schools, which teach that the self is not conscious, but the self is kind of associated with consciousness. It's what they call conjoined with consciousness. This is a very philosophical passage. I'm sorry about that. There's not much to do. It's associated, conjoined or associated with consciousness, so it can know things, but it is not itself conscious. In fact, it is more like an inert thing itself. And so what they say, so what Shantideva says, if permanent, the self like space would clearly have no action. So if you say that the self is permanent, then it can't have any action, because in order to act, you have to change. And if you're changing, you're not permanent. When it encounters other conditions, what acts on the unchanging? So you might say that permanent thing is permanent until a condition then acts upon it. But if it is permanent, then nothing could act on it. Otherwise, they'd change it. It would become impermanent. For example, space, the non-composite space, can be considered permanent. It never changes. And no conditions can act on space, because you can't engage with space. It's just there. It kind of allows other things to occur, but it doesn't have any action of its own. It just is there. And in fact, it's hard to say that it even exists. So there's nothing that could act on an inert self, an inert and permanent self. So we can therefore can't be made to act by other conditions. And for that reason, you can't really get angry at it either. If during the action it's like before, what does the action do to it? If you say this is what acts on it, then what is it that's related? So if during the action that self is the same as it was before the action, then the action isn't doing anything to it. Like when you try to do something to space, you can wave something around through space, you can poke space, you can shoot things at the space all you want, but you aren't changing space at all, because space can't be affected like that. The action is not affecting it. Similarly, if the self is permanent, then no action can affect it. And if you say that something else is acting on it, then there's no way you can establish any relationship between that other thing and the self, between that and that permanent self. So therefore, you cannot say that there is this permanent self that, because of through various ways, can act as a conscious agent. In this way, everything's dependent and thus has no control. When you know that, you won't get angry at any illusory thing. So when we understand that we've spent the first several verses of this section talking about how people are dependent on causes and conditions, we talked about how now there's no soul, using the Vaisheshika and the Nyaya view and the Samkhya view, these three views. So we've found that there isn't a soul. Actually, it'd be interesting to look at this in terms of the Christian. Of course, Shantideva in 8th century India didn't have a lot of contact with Christianity. Unless we believe the Gospels of Thomas or something. Anyways, they didn't. There was no debate with Christians in Indian. Very little debate about Christianity in Indian philosophy, I haven't seen any discussion of it. But if we think about the idea of a conscious soul, as in the Christian taught in the Christian, then it would probably the specifics would be different, but the refutation or the basic logic would be the same as here, that if you have something that's permanent, a permanent eternal soul, then nothing can act on it. And it can't act upon anything else, otherwise it'd be changing and impermanent. But again, this probably depends a lot on your definitions of permanent, impermanent. What do we mean when we say an eternal soul in Christianity? And how can you have something eternal that is created? These are all very difficult questions, but Shantideva doesn't talk about them, so I better leave it. Especially with a philosophy professor in the back of the room. But at least he's philosophy and not theology, then I'd really be in hot water. So everything's dependent and thus has no control. When the conditions come together for something to happen, it's going to occur. That's just the nature of interdependence. When the conditions aren't together, then they don't occur. If you have a seed but no soil, no water, the seed is not going to grow. But when there's a seed, soil, water, warmth, and all the other conditions that are needed, that seed is going to grow. just as, I mean, a pretty basic analogy. But when the conditions happen, when there is a sentient being who has all the seeds of the afflictions because they're an ordinary sentient being, when there is something that they unpleasant, and when they have that inappropriate attention, that unpleasant thing is near them, they are going to get angry. That's just how it happens. And when they get angry, they're going to lose control and they're going to do something that harms you, whether physical or verbal or whatever, however they act to harm you. That's just the nature of how it works. You can look at yourself. When the conditions that cause you to get angry happen, can you resist your own anger? Very difficult. Very, very difficult. That's why there's no austerity like patience. So, in this way, everything is becoming coming because of causes and conditions in interdependence, and there's no real thing. It's all like illusions. When you know that, you won't get angry at any illusory thing. That other person seems to us like they're someone, like an agent, a conscious person, a real, in control of themselves, but they're not. Coming together because of causes and conditions, the body's coming together because of causes and conditions, their mind is coming together because of causes and conditions. It's just like the same conditions that can create a character in a video game or on a movie. There's really no difference, just causes and conditions producing an appearance of someone who's acting. And when you understand that that's how it is, it's the causes and conditions producing that appearance, then how do you get angry at that? This is basically using the Mahayana teaching of the illusory nature of all phenomena as a way of understanding that that getting angry is not really going to be beneficial to ourselves. And there is something in here further along. The Chandras. Where's that in the next? Sorry, I took a note somewhere in here. I've already gone by it. All right, it's coming up. I haven't missed it yet. Good. There it is. All right. A point that I wanted to talk about, and I'm trying to remember which verse it goes with in the text, and we haven't got there yet, so I can talk about it in a moment. Okay. So this idea that everything is depending upon causes and conditions and everything is illusory nature, it's kind of a hard one to get and a hard one to accept, the idea, because we think of ourselves as being solid, real beings. We think of other people as being solid, real beings. But so to actually understand that we just come together from moment to moment. When you think about your body, the atoms in your body, apparently you recycle all the atoms in your body over the course of 7 years, someone told me?
Cells?
Okay, thank you. Cells. All the cells in your body recycle over the course of 7 years. So for myself, I have recycled everything 7.5 times. So which of those is me? Which of those is my body? When you think about your mind, that's the thoughts come in your mind, they come through cycles, they go through cycles, and there are periods of your life where you'd like to have one type of thought more than another. But are any of them you? Do you have control over the thoughts? When you sit down, you know from your shamatha meditation, you don't necessarily have a lot of control over what's going to come into your mind when you're trying to do meditation. And are any of those you? It's all like things coming together for various conditions that we don't know, we don't understand on a conscious level. Causes and conditions producing thoughts to come. One thought leads to another, then it goes off on a tangent. And then the body, something happens in the body that affects the mind. Something happens in the mind that affects the body. It's like all these causes and conditions, when you assume that there's a real me that's directing it all, but where is it? We can't find it. It's all like an illusion. So we think to ourselves, there's something that we can, that'll stop us, so when we think about that, then there's really nothing there. But then you might have this doubt. If it's all like illusion, then how can you stop anger? How can you avert anger? Even trying to stop anger wouldn't make sense because there's nothing there to stop. It's like causes and conditions. What can you do? It's like this, constantly shifting flux, and what can you do? And so this is what the next sentence is talking about. Basically, this idea that if everything is illusory and everyone, then it wouldn't be illogical to meditate on patience. So what Shantideva, what it says, the first two lines are the opponent speaking, the person who has a step. Who averts what? Even averting would be illogical. Now he's leaving a lot of words out here. Who, what sentient being, what real sentient being, who could avert what anger and what suffering? Even averting that anger and suffering wouldn't make any sense because there's no one to experience it if everyone's like an illusion. So Shantideva's response is that it's logical to say that suffering will cease dependent on that. So what he's saying is that because there's a sequence of causes and conditions, suffering comes out of specific causes. Even though things are an illusion, the illusions appear out of causes and conditions. When you have the illusion of a movie on your TV screen, or on your big screen, or do we call them TV screens anymore? Yeah, and we call them on your screen. When you're looking at your device or your big screen, you've got an illusion of activity happening. But that comes because of causes and conditions, the software, the physical thing, and all that coming together to produce that illusion. Same when you're working with like a video game where it's an illusion. In ancient India, they created illusions out of sticks and pebbles. So without those sticks and pebbles, those causes, they couldn't create the illusions. It's the same with a movie. So when you can stop the causes and conditions that produce the illusion of sentient beings and the illusion of anger, then you will be able to stop the illusion of suffering. And that's the goal. And the suffering isn't any more real than anything else, but not realize that, we experience it as suffering. So when we stop the conditions that produce that illusion of suffering, then we will be free of suffering. And then there's a kind of a summary of this, and the summary is on two stanzas. This: when you see a friend or foe acting improperly, think happily that this occurred because of such conditions. If things were accomplished by free will, no living being at all would ever have any suffering, for no one wants to suffer. If we all had a choice, if there were something that we could do, if we had our druthers, no one would ever, everyone would be in bliss all the time. Because no one really, that's what everyone wants. We'd all like to be in whatever idea of bliss is, whether it be a tropical island or Maine in autumn, I don't know. But we would always be happy because no one wants it. The people who are acting towards in ways that offend us or harm us are acting that way because they want to bring happiness for themselves but just don't know how to do it in a skillful way. So when you see a friend or foe acting improperly, think happily that this occurred because of such conditions. You just understand this causes and conditions bringing it together, making this illusion making this appearance of people acting in this way. Just should think in this way. So this is the discussion of the patience of patience of contemplating the Dharma. And here in the commentary, this commentary by Pallitsula Trungpa. Sorry, I'm going to have to start. I feel like a librarian. Changing the glasses. Now I can't see anything. And now I can't see you. You're all these blurs out there, but these are very clear. Okay. So in talking about this type of... it's really bad looking out there. I'm sorry. I have to look at my book for the moment. When we talk about these types of suffering, I guess I just have to get used to all being clear, being blurry. This is my own accepting the suffering of having declining faculties. when we're talking about this type of contemplating the suffering, contemplating the Dharma as a way of practicing the Dharma, here what we're talking about is on a very basic level. This is just kind of like the first level of it, understanding that things come because of causes conditions. But when we understand that everything is empty, then the practice of patience is different. As it says here in a quotation from the Sutra of Akashgarbha, it says, it is this, because words are like space, when you are criticized, you do not criticize back. Because the body is the same as space, when you are beaten, you do not beat back. Because the mind is the same as space, when you are reviled, you do not revile back. Because thoughts are the same as space, when someone is angry at you, you do not respond in anger. So these four dharmas are the patience of being like space. So another one. Where's that other one? So basically, when you understand that everything is insubstantial and doesn't have any independent existence, that it all comes because of causes and conditions, and there's nothing real to any of it, that it's emptiness. When you have that understanding of emptiness, then you will be able to put up with whatever occurs. You'll be able to accept anything because you understand how it happens, that none of it is real. Now, that's a fairly high level of understanding to have. And it takes a while for us to get it. And we have to think and we have to contemplate. Some people are more inclined to these contemplations of Madhyamaka, the middle way philosophy, than others. But still, what's important is to realize is that what we think is real is not. When we perceive things, we see something coming towards us as a threat. That is our perception that it is a threat, but it is not anything real as a threat. That what we're perceiving is just projections of our own mind. And depending upon how you look at things, different people can see things entirely differently. Some people, you might be two people right next to each other who see something coming towards you. One person might perceive it as a threat. One person would perceive it as a friend. And what's the difference? There's nothing in the outside object. It's just our own minds, how we're looking, how we're seeing. And so when we understand that, we understand that everything is happening because of causes and conditions, and our perceptions of them are really just our own projections, we will not respond in anger when we have these situations come up. So I think that's completing a section today. And we will continue tomorrow from the next part, but we've got about half an hour left. And so I think we've got some time for questions. And it looks like Angela has one.
Yeah. I somehow want to put consciousness in here. Now, it's not... We would agree that we see things and we see things differently.
Mm-hmm.
Would we also agree that emptiness is our consciousness? We know that we see,
but when we look for our consciousness, we can't find it. So how can we say it's emptiness?
Okay, we can't say it's anything.
Right. But we still know.
Right.
Yeah. So that projection is nothing other than your consciousness. Our perceptions are nothing other than the consciousness. What we see and we assume is something other...
It's separate from the consciousness.
Right. What we see and we assume is something separate from ourselves is not, because what we're seeing is just an image in our own mind.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Ah, too much philosophy today, no questions. Okay, Meg and then John. Mm-hmm.
This morning, I was thinking, okay, I can understand that somewhat for myself. But what if I have a classroom of girls and boys?
Mm-hmm.
And how would I go about sharing that when understand the idea of fairness.
Well,
or boys, yeah.
Or boys, yeah. Well, and kids often get pretty worked up about that's not fair. It's like, that's life, often is the answer, because life is not fair. That's not the point. I mean, and from we look at it the Buddhist perspective, the nature of samsara, one way you could put it is that it's not fair. It's never right. It's never okay. But that's a deeper understanding that children, especially in this culture, are not going to have. And so in that context, because what you're doing is going to create a situation, is going to help those children grow into people who will then have to act in ways. And so obviously in the social context of what you're looking at, not in the karmic context of your own practice or of those children, but in the social context, we want to do things that are going to create better equality and better advantages for everyone. So in that case, you have to do, you know, whatever is going to help the children understand the importance of treating everyone equally and of accepting differences and giving people equal opportunities as much as you can. And I'm sure that in the educational community, there is a lot of literature about that. So when you're teaching the children, that's the way to go. You know, and I can't give any, I'm certainly not in a position to give any advice about that. The only school that the only schools I have much contact with are in Nepal, and the one that I have more contact with, all the kids are boys, so there's no issue of gender inequality there. The girls are in a different school, the nuns are in a different school, and the monks are in a different school. So what do I, that's just the situation there. But here in this context, having the part of it is understanding for yourself. When I'm talking about not about seeing things as fair and unfair and stuff, I'm thinking about it in terms of what it's doing in terms of the judgmental, being judgmental, creating feelings of us and them, good, bad, dualistic thoughts within your own mind. I'm not talking about it on a social level. So that when you're seeing in your own mind, you aren't clouded by the dualistic perceptions of even male, female. You know, when we think about things in terms of when we, so that your understanding of the situation doesn't become a block or an impediment to you developing a deeper understanding of the Dharma. That's the way. That's the perspective I'm coming from. So on the worldly level of how you then deal with it in a classroom, I think you probably know a lot better about that than I do, right? Now, another thing that you talked about, that you said about what to do, you know, if we want to become a Buddhahood, so should I pray to be born? I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but something about, so should I try to do good karma to become reborn as a male in my next lifetime or not? And that's an issue that I don't think my answer was wrong, but it wasn't complete. So eventually we want to keep our eye on the prize. We want to be focused on achieving Buddhahood in the future. Now, Buddhahood in the future, if we take the context is going to take a number of lifetimes, 7 or 16 or however many it's going to take. If we're diligent this lifetime, if we're not 7, 16, or 3 uncountable eons. So what we want to do in our next lifetime is we want to train our minds now so that we will be able to be in a position where we can practice Dharma in the future, in the next lifetime. So that means probably being reborn human. Whatever human means in that realm that we're reborn in a place where the teachings of the Buddha, and not just human, but also in a position where we can practice the Dharma. So, in ancient India, where it was an extremely sexist society, this meant being born male, because women, girls, were married off at the age of 12 or 13. And so at that time, the prayer in that context was, I want to be reborn male, because then I'm going to have more freedom to do what I want. In this day and age, it's a different situation. In some ways, we look at it, there are more opportunities for women to practice Dharma than men. So you could maybe say that being reborn woman, if you're in a society such as this one, that being reborn female is advantageous. I don't know. It's hard to say. But the point is that you want to make the aspiration and perform the actions that will lead to rebirth in a situation you can practice the Dharma. And for myself, I don't care what gender I happen to be in my next lifetime, as long as I can practice Dharma. It doesn't matter. It's like secondary importance, you know. Okay.
So you were talking before about traffic.
Oh yeah.
I do live in Massachusetts.
Yeah. So that's a good example for you.
One thing, you know, this talks about sort of like you have a problem with a particular person,
mm-hmm.
and you know, looking at in terms of their the fact that they're from a certain perspective, they're faultless. So why get the most challenging things that I always see, like, for instance, driving on 128, is that you see the same things over and over, the same frustrating things, and you think that it's not going to end. And that's when it gets the most frustrating. And if you live up in Maine, you get cut off the track, you look down, and it's Massachusetts.
You see that. And they're seeing your plates today, too.
So that's, like, what do you do, like, and I can think of situations at work where it's like, there's like a pattern that you see, and it's hard to see how people are going to stop doing things a certain way.
Well, it's just the nature of samsara. People are always going to do stupid things that cause problems for each other until they're all brought to the state of Buddhahood. I mean, that's just the nature of samsara, is that when there is traffic, there is going to be road rage. When there is a vacation land, there are going to be Massachusetts drivers. So part of it is looking at and seeing that So one day it's a yellow convertible, the next day it's a red convertible on Route 128. Different beings reacting to the same, similar causes and conditions in similar ways that cause certain problems. Might be youthful drivers who have too much testosterone. It might be, people who, you know, they're just driving like idiots. It might be people who really shouldn't be driving at all. Whatever it is, their causes and conditions, they feel like they have to drive, and they feel like they should drive in a certain way. They want to get someplace, they're in a hurry, they're sick of being in traffic, and their reaction to being sick and being in traffic is they're going to make it more enjoyable by kind of risking things a little bit. And so that boredom is what's impelling them, you know? They feel like they have to do it. They aren't really, on one level, they're making a decision, yes, I'm going to drive like that. On another level, it looks like they're not in control of their own impulses. That's what this text is saying. And I think anytime you have just traffic like that, you know, you're going to have people who are driving. Well, not necessarily. People are really good in Hong Kong, except for the people in their supercars. Yeah. Anyways, but it's really, look, no matter what the situation, it's basically the nature of samsara, that as long as we're in samsara, people are going to be doing offensive things to us. And just not much to do about it. Yes.
You're speaking about time being short.
Yeah.
And our not knowing when we could die or become ill.
Uh-huh. Well, some of them, like with Kenpo Tsultum Gyatso Rinpoche, he hasn't spoken for a number of years. I don't know what the condition is. I think he had some strokes and things, but I'm not sure. I haven't heard about Alzheimer's in particular. Alzheimer's seems more typical condition in, or more common condition in this society, but maybe it's just not diagnosed among Tibetans. Traditionally, up until recently, Tibetans died pretty young, 50, 60. 60 years old was considered like we consider 80 or 90 among Tibetans because of the situation. So in that instance, I think Alzheimer's might be one of those diseases that you just didn't live long enough to get. And we don't really know what the causes of Alzheimer's are. And I haven't really been reading a lot about it, but sometimes you see that it might be some, people are speculating that it might be an environmental cause here. So I really don't know. They certainly, in Tibetan society, people know about older people getting older and losing their faculties. So dementia, in other words, yeah. So I wish I, but the great masters, perhaps their meditation, it's a different matter. Lots of things are different with them. Most people do not sit in meditation for 8 days after they pass away. Most people don't. Most people don't even sit in, so Kenpo Carter sat in meditation for 8 days after he died a couple of weeks ago. Lots of other people who are not well known sit for 3 days, 4 days in meditation, so you can't explain that. So I don't know what's going on. They're different, a little different. Yeah, Steve. Well, I only know about Kenpo Carter's passing in second hand because I was not there. I went down and was there on the day of the cremation, and I also visited KTD and Karma Ling last week. So I don't know that I necessarily have... I mean, several of you were at Karma Ling for a couple of days a week ago. So you probably have more... information. But I think the important thing about Kenpo Carter is when we look at him and someone who dedicated his entire life to the Dharma and was doing Dharma activities up till the day he died, constantly doing things. And he slowed down his last few years, but he was still always working hard and doing what he could. And especially his last year, we can do that too. That's the most important thing to realize. It's up to us. We can become just like Kenpo Carter. We can be like Khenchen Trungpa Rinpoche. We can be like all of these great older masters who have done that. We can do it. They started out just like us. When you think about Kenpo Carter Rinpoche, he worked hard to get to where he was. He studied hard. He memorized a lot. He did a lot of meditation practice. And it's because of that that he was able to become what he is. And there's nothing stopping us from doing the same. Nothing. So we can do it too. That's the main thing to think about. I think some of you might not know about who we're talking about. I should probably mention that. Kenpo Carter Rinpoche was the main lama at KTD in Woodstock, New York. He was sent there in the 1970s. He was born in 1923. And he just passed away... four weeks ago today. And so he spent his entire life really, you know, from the time that he entered the monastery as a young boy, he studied hard. He later went through Shudra with our teacher, Khenchen Trungpa Rinpoche. So right now, Kenpo Carter's picture is in the middle of the shrine. Khenchen Trungpa Rinpoche is on the right side facing it. And they went through Shudra together, they studied together, they escaped from Tibet together, they went to Rumtek Monastery together and stayed there throughout the 1960s and the first half of the 1970s together. They both studied and worked hard. Then Kenpo Carter Rinpoche was sent to New York and worked hard to build KTD from really nothing to what it is today. And he's been teaching the Dharmas, and there are lots of wonderful stories you can read about him on Facebook and so forth. And finally, after 96 years, he had done everything he wanted to do. And he kind of left his students lots of clues. So at the end of a teaching this year, apparently, he said, "Now I've done everything I need to do. I feel like my life's work is..." not exactly this, but he basically, "I've done everything I need to do. I'm so happy that I've been able to arrange all this. This is excellent." Passing on things, like giving big warning signs. But of course, the students didn't want to believe it. Some of them did. Some of them knew it was happening, but some didn't. And then he passed away really fairly quickly. He had a stroke and then was passed away a couple days later. After he passed away, he did what many accomplished meditators do. Tibetan and non-Tibetan, there are some non-Tibetans who've sat in the death meditation, the Thukdam death meditation. And he sat in that meditation for 8 days. And during those 8 days, the circulation, the heart had stopped, all this metabolism had stopped. And he still had warmth in his body until the eighth day, sitting in meditation. And then at the end of the eighth day, he left the meditation. His cremation was held 2 weeks ago tomorrow. So he worked hard. He was fortunate to get the instructions to meet great teachers, and he made the best use of his time that he could. And this is a result. And there's thousands of people in North America, especially, who had a great connection with him, who've benefited greatly. And even though this is a Trangu Dharma Center, I mean, Kenpo Carter Rinpoche started out as a Trangu Lama as well. He's part, you know. He was at Kenpo and Trangu Monastery first, and a lot of the members of the center have been to KTD over the years, and many of you have received teachings from Kenpo Carter Rinpoche, and actually more teachings than I have, because I have not taken any teachings from Kenpo Carter Rinpoche. But he's an example of what we can do if we take this opportunity and use it. I wonder if this would be a good time to... What time have we got? My watch broke, and so I'm reduced to looking at timepieces. We've still got a few more minutes. It's 4:15 now. Oh, you have a question? Sure.
I guess I'm wondering, in this teaching, is there a value to having feelings of anger and working effectively with those feelings and without acting out the anger in a harmful way? And I'm thinking in the context of I work with many people who are victims of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And many of whom, or some of whom, are at risk for being killed by their partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk sometimes at work about people experiencing pathological empathy, meaning they can't get in touch with their anger enough to protect themselves or their children.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about using, helping people experience their anger in an effective way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's this is one of the interesting things about when we bring traditional Dharma teachings, which is what I've been studying, and bring it into this context where we have, in this society, very different ways of working with it. And I think when you have people, if they're in a situation, we can't stop anger, but we can't stop anger from happening by repressing it, by blocking it. That won't work. And so, then I think you end up in a situation similar. These are that pathological empathy is a way where they've squelched their anger to stay in that situation, and that obviously is an unhealthy situation from them from many different perspectives. And so, they're already angry, even if they aren't able to express it. So if there's a skillful way that they can let that out without, or deal with it without acting on it, that's the point. But having to find some, of course, if it's the only way to protect them and their children, then it's better than the alternative, far better than the alternative. Here we're talking about it particularly in the context of people who are on the bodhisattva path, people who are practicing patience. Who've made the commitment of a bodhisattva, I'm going to achieve Buddhahood. And I'm assuming that most of your clients probably are not in that situation. So it's a different point. But the harm of anger is great, even if you're not practicing Buddhist. The defects, the results that it brings are harmful. So if there's some way that they can get and understand their feelings, to a point where they can deal with them and act in a way that they need to get themselves to safety and protection without acting in a way that causes harm. Because what anger does is the anger is itself not a harmful act. It is not a misdeed. It is an affliction. And when you take that anger and then you act out of that in a way that would cause them to kill their spouse, harm their harm the abuser, something like that, that would be a negative action. So if there's some way that they can figure out what that anger is and then deal with it in a constructive way, then I think that's probably good. But at some point, once they're out of that current situation, then you have to start looking at it. I mean, you have to kind of look at it in terms of where each individual is and what's going to be helpful for that individual person. And if for that person saying you must not ever get angry is going to perpetuate a bad situation, then that's not a skillful way of acting. So you deal with this, let's get you out, let's get you safe, and then maybe at some point in the future then they can start looking at the anger as in terms of this sort of teaching. At some point, the other aspect of the teaching of patience that we haven't talked about is the aspect of forgiveness. That is an aspect of patience. In fact, forgiving people have hurt us in the past. And so if people who are in situations like that, if they continue to hold on to their anger years and years later, then that's not going to help them. You have to get them out of the situation, but then unless you can find some way to come to peace and come to some level of forgiveness, then that anger is going to haunt them for the rest of their lives. And so that's maybe something, a future step after they're safe. Okay, what else? Tomorrow morning, at the end of the morning session, at least one person wants to take refuge vows, and if there are other people who want to take refuge vows, that can be arranged. I'm happy to have one person, three people. It's more or less, we're pretty similar. So I just wanted to let you know, and we'll talk a little bit about refuge then, to give you some idea of what we mean when we talk about going for refuge. And I think this might also be a good point to say a little bit about, last night I mentioned it in brief, we're kind of doing this as a fundraiser, and I'm coming here, my upkeep while I'm here is being very generously taken care of, and I'm delighted with the care that I have received. I'm happy to accept this generosity. I like the generosity and kind, especially in terms of warm places to stay and good food. But for myself personally, when I look at what happens when people come, and people are very generous with me and have been for many years, this is the reason, one of the reasons why I'm in this position that I am now. People come and they give me offerings, and I really appreciate it, and I look at it as a chance to make a connection with a lot of people. But at the same time, for me, there's something that's kind of uncomfortable about it. And the reason I find it uncomfortable is I think people are going to give me offerings, and I'm going to use them well. I'm going to give it away. I'm going to do something. And then what happens? I give part of it away, but then I fritter a lot of it away on myself. No, I'm serious. And then, you know, here I'm working on the way of the Bodhisattva, and it says, if someone who thinks to give some trifling little thing, but then does not, is reborn as a hungry ghost, and I think to myself, all those offerings, how many lifetimes have I got of the hungry ghost coming? How many offerings that I could have given away have been converted into some useless thing, some cup of tea, or even worse, cups of coffee? Spending it on myself when I'd originally thought I'm going to give it away. And I don't want to be in that position. It's not comfortable for me. It's like when you're giving an addict, you give an addict the thing they're addicted to, it doesn't help. So I don't want for myself. I don't want to be in that position where I'm going to get something, have a noble thought, and then muck it up. I'd rather do it cleanly. So that's kind of the first thing. And the other thing is that because of my karma. As I mentioned earlier, I was born in a very fortunate position. And since I'm in a fortunate position, well, a fortunate position helped by the stock market over the last 20 years, I'm in a fortunate position, and I don't need money. So, but Dharma centers need money, right? Because this place costs money, costs more than the previous space that you all were in last year, up for 10 years. And other people need money more than I do. So when I come and I teach, if I just say, I don't want any money, I tried that once and it ended up actually not being very comfortable for me either. It's like, that's too far. So now I'm trying to find the happy middle. I'll take the money, I'll appreciate your offerings, but I'm not going to look at how much is in each of them. And then I, you know, pass it along to the center here. And this is what I've done at all the places I've been this year. I've just been taking the envelopes. Some of them I've taken the money out of envelopes and then kind of consolidated and given it to the center. Some of them I've just given the envelopes and say, here, there you go. And so for myself, I feel like this is a better way to do it because I honestly don't need money. And I mean, if I were to live in the United States, I would probably need money, but I don't, living the way I do. That being said, you might say, okay, this has been a free program. Last year we had to pay, and then we had to give Kempo David an offering on top of that. And this year it's cheap. But it's your opportunity. First of all, when you make an offering to me, indirectly you're making an offering to the center. So for your own part, when you look at it as someone who's making, especially if you're thinking about good karma, making offerings to the three jewels. Now, I don't have any special qualities. I'm just an ordinary person. I've got all the afflictions, and I act on them all, unfortunately. But I represent something. I was given a title. I wear the robes, and it's not the qualities of me. I'm doing my best to try to teach you the teachings as I've been taught, the meaning that I've understood from the reading and the teachings I've received. And so when you make an offering to me, it's like you're making an offering to Trungpa Rinpoche and the Karmapa and all the teachers all the way back to the Buddha. So it's not me. It's kind of like the robes are a symbol. My name, my title is a symbol. It's certainly not my qualities in any sense because I don't really have any. So when you make an offering and thinking about that, if you make an offering with faith, then it's definite that it's going to be a real karmic benefit for you. And the best thing is that since I'm not going to be wasting it on stupid things, things that I don't really need, then it's all actually going to go to good use at the center as well, and the center needs help. I mean, it takes a lot of money to run a center and do that. Now, traditionally, teachings have been given entirely for free and supported on donations. Now, this is the way traditionally monasteries and places in Asia have worked up until the present. When the Dharma's been brought here to the United States, what's happened is the economic model here is a little different, or people's way of thinking is different. And Dharma courses are actually fairly expensive for a lot of people, especially if you go to a residential retreat. And it kind of comes to a situation where I think a lot of people might be interested in the Dharma, but they can't afford it. If you want to go, oh, there's a nice class at the whatever center. I'm not going to call any names. There's a nice, at this beautiful center, they've got a beautiful space, good teacher coming, and there are a lot of people, great teachings, and the only people who can afford to go there are people who have money. Because the expense of going there. And some of you might be in this position where you look and you say, wow, this teacher is coming to that place. I can't afford it. It's too expensive. So a lot of people might feel like they can't afford to come to Dharma programs. And part of that's because there's an entry barrier. Now, the fees for the courses here have traditionally been very low. What has it been? $30 for a weekend, I think. So, right? That's something what I remember. Higher, a little higher. Okay. Okay, so they haven't been that cheap. But you should think about it. I mean, because if you think to yourself, wow, I've had a bargain today. What a great. Teachings weren't so great, but it was a bargain anyways. Free. I'll keep coming back. They've heated the room. Tomorrow we'll even get tea. you're thinking about it in that way, you know, it's not like you've got to think about what's the value of having a place like this in Portland and what's the benefit you. So there's a karmic benefit that it'll have for you, thinking about making a connection to the lineage and to the teachings, and then also the practical benefit of what can we do to help this center stay. Because it's, you know, it's been a big jump from, I think, probably three times as much space as there was last year. It's a big jump, and there's a certain jump of expenses, and unless we all pitch in to help out, it's not going to be sustainable. So one of my suspicions, and I want to see if it is right or not, and the proof is going to be up to you this year. When you run a program like this for free, just by the cost of, about just for the donations, do you end up with more income or less income? That's an interesting thing. I have a friend, you might remember, some of you probably remember him, he was at the tent retreat in 1998 and a couple of other retreats. There's Ray Jean from Montreal. Well, he later got involved in the Goenka Center in Montreal. And the Goenka programs are kind of different than what we do. You get to the program, it's a 10-day residential program, and you don't have to pay, it's completely free. Then on the 10th day, after you've spent 10 days meditating, you're nice and softened up, they say to you, your program was free, you don't have to pay anything. But if you'd like to give someone else the same opportunity for the next retreat, we'll accept your donations. And they get a lot. In fact, they get much more than they would were they operating on a. This is dated information. This is what Rajan said when I saw him in Nepal in 2012 or 13. So they got a lot more income actually because they're accepting it entirely on donations than they would if they were setting a price for the program. So this program for you, it's a very low cost program for the center because all you're doing is paying for my food. Peter's already paying rent and got some nice blankets, so that's not too much expense. It's basically just feeding me for a few days and putting up with me, which is probably a greater expense. I don't know. But the this is a low cost program, and it may not be the same for other programs. That's up for you all to decide. But it's just my thought that what would be really nice is if we could have the Dharma be given for free. Not sold, just freely given, and people then, in response, if you like it, you give and make the Dharma available for others. So that's, like I said, I have no ownership over what you do. I have no feeling like you need to do what I say. You're your center, you make your decisions. But it's something to think about and see how it works. At any rate, I'd like to, for my own part, I plan to keep coming back in future years, and I expect that for a number of years I should be able to, barring impermanence, I should be able to fund my own trip here, and I'm happy to do it. So that's the money talk. And now we have some lobsters who are waiting for us. Be freed. Some sentient beings, we can do something concrete to help. Because when you do life release of lobsters in Maine, the good thing about this is that you're releasing them back into the environment that they came, and they can survive. They've got a better chance of surviving. When you do a life release of other things, you buy all sorts of fish from the fish market and you dump them in the bay, you have no idea how many are going to survive. But with lobsters, we've got a good chance. They've got a fighting chance.